Next case will be United States versus Meriwether Brothers. Mr. Franklin.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Andrew Franklin. I'm an attorney from Milwaukee, and I was appointed the honor of representing Mr. Meriwether today, Quan Meriwether, and I also have the honor of arguing on behalf of Christoph Meriwether. Briefly, this case is an appeal from the imposition, stay, and modification of a fallback sentence issued by the trial court that was initially entered pursuant to this court's ruling in Booker, which I'll refer to as Booker A. The two defendants pled guilty to two charges of a two-count indictment. The trial court entered a fallback sentence that was docketed as part of the original judgment on September 9th of 2004. And when the sentencing guidelines fell, which is the subject of contention in the appeal, the defendants moved for the imposition of the fallback sentence. The trial court declined to do so at the time. It made oral rulings on March 31st and then in a formal hearing on May 17th with the defendants present. They entered timely appeals from the trial court's judgment, and they now pray that the Court of Appeals enforce the original fallback sentence. The primary issues for the appeal are whether or not the fallback sentences are valid, whether or not the condition precedent was met in these appeals, whether the fallback sentence for each defendant was reasonable, and whether or not the trial court had jurisdiction to either fail to enforce the fallback sentence or to modify it. As I indicated before...
That's probably the first issue, isn't it?
I'm sorry?
The last one's probably the first issue, isn't it?
I'm sorry, the what?
The jurisdiction, whether it had jurisdiction.
Oh, the jurisdiction, yes, and it is an issue of contention.
With the Smith case.
I'm sorry?
With the Smith case, right?
Yes. It's the state's contention that there is jurisdiction. I'm sorry, it's the defendant's contention that there is jurisdiction. The state had not contested that. In the matter of Roderick Smith, as I read the court's decision, the Court of Appeals indicated that perhaps its decision would be different had there been no objection or contention as to the matter of jurisdiction, or if in fact parties had somehow stipulated that jurisdiction existed. In fact, there was that understanding that the trial court had jurisdiction to enforce the fallback sentence.
Wait a minute. Did you say they could stipulate to jurisdiction?
It was not stipulated in fact, but in essence, I think that it was agreed in this instance. And the reason why I say that...
Is that what the Smith case says?
Smith says that this court would have considered, perhaps, a different outcome as to the issue of jurisdiction if the parties had agreed to.
You mean if we were to reach that issue? They didn't reach the issue, right?
I'm terribly sorry.
I'm sorry. Did the Smith's court didn't reach that issue, did it?
I apologize. I'm having a lot of trouble hearing out of my right ear this morning.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, I'll let you proceed. I just want to make sure we... at least address this, the case that came out subsequently. And because it did address the issue we have before us.
I'm sorry, the Cage case, did you say?
No, not Cage, Smith.
Oh, well, Smith. Smith was the Seventh Circuit's case. And
yes.
The Seventh Circuit did find, as is known, that there was no jurisdiction. Because even though there might be jurisdiction to enforce or to hear the appeal from the district court denying the fallback, the court said that there was no jurisdiction, but to change the original fallback sentence. Part of that is the question of what's a final order. The United States versus Cage in the Tenth Circuit found, in fact, that there was jurisdiction, and they made that distinction when the United States appealed from the imposition of a fallback sentence on precisely similar facts, although procedurally it was a different matter. And United States versus Cage, which was cited as supplemental authority, does indicate that jurisdiction exists. And the question, I think, is twofold. One is whether or not the original judgment entering the fallback sentence is the controlling date and the final order for purposes of this appeal, or whether or not the subsequent date is. And it's our contention that, and then the other issue is whether or not the matter of jurisdiction can be resolved where the parties have not objected to jurisdiction. In our specific instance, the trial court, at the time of the resentencing on May 31st, indicated that it believed that there would be jurisdiction for an appeal of its decision in the case. The United States, in my understanding, did not contest the jurisdiction of the court to enter the fallback sentence, but rather argued whether or not the condition was met. As a matter of fact,
is that something that can be waived by the district court?
I'm sorry?
You're saying that that can be waived by the district court if the district court has no jurisdiction to consider this in the first instance?
I think that.
How can it be waived?
Well, I think, first of all, that under the circumstances where the parties have agreed that there's jurisdiction, I think that it can be waived to the extent that no objection has been made and that the parties have acted in reliance on that jurisdictional issue. But I think the larger question is whether or not it's even a matter of waiver. I think that the question is whether or not jurisdiction exists as a whole, and it depends from which perspective you go. Our perspective is that jurisdiction exists because the fallback sentence was not ripe for an appeal until after the condition was met or after the fallback was not imposed. After all, one of the problems that I think is raised in the Roderick Smith decision is this. It seems to indicate that a defendant must appeal at the time the fallback sentence is originally entered.
No, you can file a notice of appeal and then ask that everything be stayed and wait and see how things develop.
You can, but I don't think that it would be either A, a proper use of judicial resources, or B, necessarily ethical on behalf of defense attorneys. In my case specifically,
it'd be unethical to.
My client had no outward interest in appealing either facet of the sentence. And so to file a notice of appeal at the time that the sentence was entered would mean that the defendant appellant would have had to, and both in this case, would have had to position themselves to challenge something about that sentence. And with Booker A having been decided, with Booker B, the Supreme Court decision, not yet in print. The question is, should there be an appeal when a condition precedent is listed, which is the fall of the guidelines, and after that, when one looks at the sentence, there are no other issues that are desired for appeal. So, in essence, the Smith decision says file an appeal even if you don't have a complaint with the original or the fallback sentence. And I don't think that's a proper use of resources or a good position for defense attorneys to be in, or, for that matter, the United States to be in. I think that the matter needs to be ripe, and it's not ripe until either the condition subsequent is met or arguably met, or there's some type of trial court determination on that matter.
The fallback was made with the possibility that the guidelines would be completely thrown out, and therefore it would be not a factor, and those would be, for whatever, the fallback position. As it turns out, the guidelines were still viable, although we'll say substantially discounted, but meaning the fallback was basically obsolete.
Well, in this case, the fallback was made obsolete. I think that in reading Booker B, the fallback condition was met. And so from the perspective of, first of all, was the condition met? Yes.
But normally what we were doing for a while, we had these what we call Palladino remands. We were sending them back. Would the court have given the same sentence had he known that they didn't have to use the guidelines? And a lot of times the court said yes. Sometimes they said no. They would do something different. So they sent him back and resentenced. In this particular case, the court basically said, yeah, the guideline sentences are okay.
Well, what the judge, what the trial court had done is, in essence, to say the original sentence was more reasonable than the fallback sentence in light of reconsidering the sentencing guidelines. When the trial court did that, it jumped through a hoop of procedure. It changed the original sentencing scheme, and without the jurisdiction to do so. The trial court only had the jurisdiction, arguably, to either enforce or to not enforce the fallback, but not to change it. And it seemed that the trial court engaged in a method of both arguing that the condition had not been met, but also arguing that the fallback was not reasonable.
Okay. I'll give you a minute or so to rebut, since your time's run out.
Thank you.
Mr. Chapman.
May it please the court. This appeal is resolved completely by this court's prior decision in United States versus Roderick Smith. In Smith, the appellant was in a procedurally identical posture as the appellants in this case. There is no difference between these two cases. In terms of the procedures, in fact, they involve the same district court operating under the same rationale and the same decision-making. And in Smith, this court made it very clear that the district court simply lacks subject matter jurisdiction to impose the fallback sentence. And that was true with regard to whether the district court wanted to impose the fallback or didn't want to impose it. It was also true with regard to even if the government did not contest it at that time, which we did not. We didn't consent to jurisdiction. We didn't challenge it because we perceived it as the judge operating under his authority under Rule 36 to correct the judgment to conform to the oral pronouncement of sentence. And I think what the Smith case said was, that's incorrect. Even if the other parties don't raise it, there is no subject matter jurisdiction.
Now, the first Booker case, before it went to the Supreme Court, raised that subject to fallback, or said might be a good idea, or sort of a throwaway thing there at the end. Isn't that where this all came from?
In terms of the fallback sentence, Judge? Well, the issue, I think, that the Seventh Circuit decision in Booker was concerned about was the more substantive issue of whether what would happen if the guidelines were tossed out in their entirety. And that's sort of our substantive argument in the brief, which is whether the condition precedent for imposition of the fallback sentence ever took place.
Right.
The jurisdictional issue, though, seems to trump that discussion because it resolves the appeal short of having to rely or having to address the substantive matter. And in this case, again, there's no procedural difference between the two. Now, both appellants have referred the court to the Cage case out of the Tenth Circuit, and there is admittedly some tension between Cage and Smith because the Tenth Circuit in Cage does suggest that the district court maintained some residual subject matter jurisdiction to deal with the imposition of a fallback sentence after the Supreme Court's Booker decision. But the problem with Cage, of course, is that it's from the Tenth Circuit, and Smith controls in this circuit. But even if this court were to want to reconsider Smith in light of Cage, we would submit that Cage is not well decided. And it's not well decided because it doesn't address the issue that is so clearly discussed in Smith, which is the statutory limitations on a district court's authority to modify a judgment once it is issued. There's no reference to this court's Smith case. There's no reference to Section 3582C or Rule 35 or the other jurisdictional limits. The Cage court more or less seems to conclude that there's some residual jurisdiction in the district court simply because in the past they had had accepted alternative sentences around the time of Mistretta when the guidelines were first applicable to the courts. So we would submit that this court should not accept Cage. Just to clarify one point, We are not arguing that this court lacks jurisdiction. There was a timely notice of appeal of the district court's denial of the motion to modify the original judgment. That's not the issue. The question is whether the district court ever had subject matter jurisdiction to modify the judgment to impose the fallback sentence. The judgment in this case only had the guideline sentence, which, as with the defendant Smith, made the appellants, in this case, the natural appellants at the time the original judgment was issued. And because they were, as the Smith court stated, had they filed a timely notice of appeal, they would have at least protected their rights. The case could have been stayed pending the resolution of the Supreme Court's decision in Booker, which obviously we think would have resulted in a Palladino remand back to the court. If for some reason the court does conclude that there's subject matter jurisdiction within the district court, we would ask the court to affirm the district court's decision denying their motion to modify the original judgment. And the reasons for that are set forth in our brief, and they're very simply that the condition precedent for imposition of the fallback sentence never actually occurred. The district court, I think it's very clear from the language the district court used, and even from the Seventh Circuit Booker decision, that the fallback sentence was based on the theory behind the fallback sentence is based on a theory that the guidelines disappear entirely, that we go back to an indeterminate sentencing regime. And so even as Judge Holderman stated when he denied their later motion to modify the judgment, the fallback sentences in this case were his conclusion as to what the sentence should be in a completely indeterminate scheme. And we know, of course, from the Supreme Court's Booker decision that that would be an illegal sentence under the Supreme Court's Booker decision. The Supreme Court said you do not sentence a defendant as if there's an indeterminate sentencing regime. You have to consider the 3553A factors, and as part of that, you have to consider the guidelines and the guideline range, which Judge Holderman stated very clearly he did not do in setting the fallback sentences. So to require the district court to go back and impose the fallback sentence would essentially be requiring the district court to impose a sentence that would violate the Supreme Court's dictate in Booker. Unless the court has any further questions, we'll rest.
No, that's fine. Well, I guess I said you could have a little more time if you needed it.
Thank you. I'll be very brief.
Go ahead.
Regarding the issue of jurisdiction, when the original sentence was entered, the state did not appeal. The state did not appeal and maintain jurisdiction from that order. The United States, nor did the defense. The only time that the issue of jurisdiction was ever raised was after an assumedly valid fallback sentence was ready for execution, or perhaps not. So, assuming that a fallback sentence is a valid sentence, the only issue for the trial court, for the sentencing court, would have been to impose or not impose the sentence that was the fallback sentence. Instead, the court engaged in a debate about reasonableness. And instead of determining whether or not a sentence would have been reasonable under the guidelines had they been considered as advisory, the trial court instead chose between the original sentence and the fallback sentence and said the original sentence was reasonable, the second one, the fallback, was not, or at least it was more reasonable. Thus, the trial court engaged in a resentencing that it should not have done.
Okay. Thanks. This case will be taken under advisement. As you indicated earlier, you were court-appointed, and we appreciate your taking the assignment and for the advocacy for your clients.
Thank you, Judge.